This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are talking climate today. UMass Boston updated forecasts on the impacts of climate change in the greater Boston region yesterday. The numbers are disturbing. We could see as many as 80 days per year with temperatures above 90 degrees. Groundwater volume could drop by 18%, and by 2050, Morrissey Boulevard could flood as frequently as every other day. Now, if you're in charge of a city or a town and you have to plan for all of that, mitigate it, how do you do it? Boston's gearing up. Sanjay Sait has a plan. He is the Climate Resilience Program Manager for the City of Boston. Joins us now. Sanjay, welcome back.
Great to be with you this morning. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, you know, heat waves, huge storms, flooding, maybe drought. You have a lot on your plate. I want to know if the extremes outlined in yesterday's report, these updated forecasts from a report 5 years ago, surprised you at all, Sanjay.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And so did they surprise me? I think what is clear about this report and the other reports we're seeing at local, regional, national, international levels is there is incredible consistency from the scientific community throughout the world that these are the impacts we're facing. So the city of Boston is not surprised by what we're seeing in the GBRAG report, but what we are seeing is that with ever increasing confidence, the scientific community is lighting that warning and telling us, hey, our behavior does need to change.
So if I'm hearing you, it's not surprising. And yet each time one of these reports comes out, like the one yesterday, it's just reaffirming, no, seriously, this is what we're doing and you've got to adapt.
Yeah, I think one key message that I want people to always hear when these reports come out is that these are projections. We're not prisoners to these projections. They're just showing us the consequences of our decisions and the consequences if we don't change our behavior. So the important message to take from these reports is that getting climate change under control is incredibly serious, and we can do it. It just requires significant investment and transformation.
So two things I want to ask you about that, Sanjay. The first is there are a few things in yesterday's report that are not sort of this is what's going to happen if we don't change our behavior. A couple of things in that report were this is baked in because of behavior we've already had, right?
Yes.
And that's around heat, at least.
Exactly. Even if we reduce our emissions significantly, which, you know, every city, every country is making commitments to do that, we have already done things that are going to increase the heat, that are going to increase precipitation, going to increase the intensity of storms and change our exposure to the risks that we'll face from climate change. However, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't continue to reduce our emissions,
right.
But it means that it's even more urgent to do it as soon as possible so that we can protect people who are vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, which is, in essence, all of us.
So let's stay there for my second question. So for things that we do need to prepare for, so if you're looking at a two-pronged approach here, one is reduction to avoid what's coming in the future. The other is prepare to be resilient in case what's coming actually happens. Is that fair?
Exactly. You do both
okay.
at the same time.
So let's look in that preparedness space. And I want to hit a couple of these big themes. One of the things that really struck me from the report was the frequency of what we would call a nuisance flood and how one thinks about that. So maybe you could explain for listeners what a nuisance flood is and what we're looking at in terms of how frequently those could happen. And what do you do to plan for that?
Yeah. So for folks who don't know what a nuisance flood is, it's just saying that, you know, as the sea levels rise, the high tide line is going to become higher. And so what used to be a yearly or a monthly flood starts to become like an every week or an every other day thing. And what that means is that all of our low-lying infrastructure, things we depend on, like roads and public transit, things that are built right near the water, it means that we have to act to protect that infrastructure and adapt that infrastructure so that it still functions.
So,
under future conditions.
So what are some of the things that you do for that adaptation so that it still functions?
Exactly. So, you know, in the case of Morrissey Boulevard, the City of Boston produced coastal resilience solutions for Dorchester, which outlined a range of strategies to elevate and protect that area so that it can actually be functional under Boston's projections for sea level rise. And what that means is sometimes you increase the land under the road so that the road's just higher. Sometimes you're preparing barriers or other solutions to kind of protect from water coming over the land and onto the road, there's a pretty wide range of actions you can take. And ultimately, it's not that we don't know what actions we need to take. It's that there's an increasing urgency, and this report outlines the urgency of getting that action done in time.
You're listening to Radio Boston. We're talking with Sanjay Sait, who's the Climate Resilience Program Manager for the City of Boston. So nuisance flooding, is that a challenge for communities close to the waterfront? Is that something that inland Massachusetts cities and towns don't need to think about?
So nuisance flooding typically refers to stuff related to the ocean, right? So you're usually talking about high tides. But you're also, when we talk about inland communities or communities that aren't right on the coast, there's a lot of additional flooding concerns that are brought up in this report. In particular, the question around stormwater flooding, which just means during a big storm, a lot of rain is dropped on a city or a town. And how do we deal with that? What we saw in Hurricane Ida in New York was that folks that lived in basement apartments or in low-lying areas experienced a lot of flooding, even though they weren't right on the coast. And so climate change is something that affects all of us, whether you're coastal, whether you're inland. And each issue and each kind of group of people face a wide range of issues. It's not always going to be the same for everyone, but it's critical to make sure that we take action on all of those at the same time to protect people from these risks.
Now, groundwater, which turns into potable drinking water, is something that everyone in the Commonwealth needs. The report notes that groundwater contributes to 52 to 76% of the potable water withdrawals in Norfolk, Plymouth, and Middlesex counties. But we could be looking at significant groundwater reduction. So how does a community like Boston plan for that? I mean, water's water.
Water is water. And what is the world without water? Yeah, exactly. I think every community in the country is thinking about that, especially if they're a coastal community. In Boston, our source of water is very far from the city. We're part of a broader regional system for drinking water. And so our drinking water source isn't right on the coast. But for some communities whose drinking water system is on the coast, continued study of the question of groundwater rise, which for folks who might not be familiar, that just means that as sea levels rise, sometimes that means the groundwater rises with it and mixes with the salt water. So are people going to have saltier water? Is the groundwater table going to drop during heat waves? These are the questions that need to continue to be explored in the Commonwealth. And groundwater rise is something new in this report and something that is worth continued study to understand. How does rising groundwater affect our waste management sites on the coast, our Superfund sites on the coast, and of course, our drinking water access?
Why is this something new in 2022? Why was it not something we were looking at in 2016?
I think you can talk to the UMass folks to see maybe why they wanted to include it. We encourage them to include this in the report because we've learned through additional study and partnership with folks across the country that groundwater is a critical question in the climate challenge. And you can look at communities in South Florida who have an unconsolidated aquifer. What that means is that the salt water and fresh water mix openly. And as sea levels rise, access to water is going to be really problematic in South Florida, or could be without action. California is looking at this as well. So it's becoming a more common issue to discuss in the climate space, in addition to the kind of classics of sea level rise, precipitation, and heat.
Okay, before I let you go, I also want to talk about heat islands, something we've talked about recently here on the show. And with increased warming, we've got infrastructure here. Barbara Moran, who will join us in a bit, was on yesterday talking about this. That is not designed to withstand or not absorb and hold on to the kind of extreme heat that we could be looking at. So, I mean, infrastructure, buildings, roads, that's big long-term stuff. What do you do?
Glad you asked. So on Earth Day this year, Mayor Wu announced the city's heat resilience plan, which is a citywide plan with 26 different strategies in it to make sure that Boston can prepare for extreme heat. A lot of the things you need to do around heat are about, you know, it's about infrastructure, but it's also about people. It's about the people who are disproportionately affected by a heat wave, both today and in the future. So folks who are elderly, folks who are young, who are unhoused, who are outdoor workers or have illnesses. When you think about putting people at the center of the climate work, heat is one of those things that lets you do it because everyone knows what it's like to be hot on a hot day. So there's a lot you can do in terms of preparing your infrastructure, making sure that your energy systems can withstand the increased demand for air conditioning, and actually improve the public realm. Invest in trees, invest in cooling pavements, invest in all of these resources that allow us to protect people and actually improve the quality of life and deliver on environmental justice as well. So heat is a really, people are going to be aware of it this summer. It's something that is covered really well in this report. And if you dig into the report and the city's report, what it allowed us to do is also talk about days over 80 and days over 90 and days over 100. So you can start to get a sense of the nuance in this report. But the key message is really just to understand that we have a need for continued urgent action on climate adaptation. It's something we can do. It's going to be challenging, but it's something we do need to do.
All right. That is Sanjay Sait, Climate Resilience Program Manager for the City of Boston, talking with us about new projections from research from UMass Boston. Sanjay, thank you.
Of course. Thank you very much.
Joining us now, Barbara Moran, who is WBUR's environmental correspondent. Barbara, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
So you walked us through the sort of the headlines of the report on the show yesterday, Barbara, and I know you just heard this conversation with Sanjay Sait. So let's start there. Your reactions to what you just heard.
Well, one thing that was really interesting, I thought, that he said, and I hear this echoed in a lot of the scientists and experts I talk to, is this idea that it's, you know, this isn't written in stone. These are projections, not predictions. And I mean, I think you did a really good follow-up on this, because some of these are, you know, baked in, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, I hear the scientists doing this like funny little dance, is like that we need to understand that some of this stuff is going to happen in the next couple of decades, but then they don't want people to like say, well, I give up, right? I'm not going right. to just keep using fossil fuels because it's all hopeless, right? Because things do really start to diverge sort of after 2050. That's where what we do now makes a real difference. So I thought that was really interesting. And the other, I thought it was really interesting, his answer on Morrissey Boulevard, where he talked about all these different things that we could do and all these plans, which are true. There's all these great plans of what to do with Morrissey Boulevard, but none of them are quite happening yet, right?
Yeah.
And this is the question, right? Like Mayor Wu proposed giving, I think, $31.5 million out of the remaining ARPA money to climate stuff in Boston. But it's like, where do you decide where to put it, right? And that's the question now. Do you spend a lot of money to raise Morrissey Boulevard? Do you spend it on heat?
Right.
What do you do with it?
So that raises a couple of questions. And I want to go back for a second, Barbara, because I think you sort of created a line of demarcation at 2050.
Yeah.
And I just want to clarify, if I'm understanding you correctly, the way one might think about it is a lot of what's in the report that is stuff that would happen between now and 2050, that's more of the baked-in stuff. And then behavior that we change now in terms of our emissions, our consumption, our alternative energies, et cetera, could really affect how we diverge in the prospects, for lack of a better word, after 2050. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Yes. Good thing you're here, Tiziana, to clear things up. But yes.
Well, no, I mean, that's a bit. I mean, I read the executive summary. I've read a bunch of articles. But that framing, I think, is really interesting. And I'm not sure I had locked in on it that way before you said it. So that makes me want to ask you, what's the ratio between, hey, we got this, and, oh, my God, in our various cities and towns planning and preparedness right now? Do you have a read on that? And I don't mean scientifically, like, you know, it's 50%, but do you have a read on that?
Well, it varies a lot. I mean, Boston has great climate plans, right? So, and they're moving ahead steadily on them, but, you know, surrounding towns, Cambridge has a plan, you know, there's a little bits of plans here and there, but most towns, cities outside of Boston don't really have planning in place, right? Or just little bits of it. And they're starting to do that, right? So I think part of this report, the city of Boston and UMass are hoping that this report will encourage cities and towns to start thinking about this and taking action. And, you know, and again, like Sait told me, it's great that Boston is doing all this, but this is, you know, it's a global problem, right? So Boston can't just be the shining city on the hill that, you know, takes care of everything, that everybody needs to chip in to some extent, if that makes sense.
It does. And just briefly, Barbara, is there infrastructure in place? I mean, like people and jobs regionally where coordination could happen, some coordinated planning could happen, just briefly?
Yeah, the MPAC, which is a regional network for Greater Boston, was a big part of this report. And so that exists. The MWRA, which is the regional water system, has been seen as a really good model to help manage some of these things. So there are some things in place, not everything. You know, there seems to be, there should be some New England-wide things as well. So there are some, but not quite enough.
Well, that is something to watch for then. WBUR's Barbara Moran, our environmental correspondent. Appreciate you giving us some wisdom there. Thanks.
Thanks, Tiziana. Always good to be here.
It's time for Tech Talk, and this week we're looking at what you do with a 1,000-pound electric car battery when it wears out. The Boston Globe's Hiawatha Bray put us onto the question in a recent column, and joining us now, the CEO of a company that is ahead of the game on electric car battery recycling here in Massachusetts. Mike O'Cronley is the CEO of Ascend Elements, which is in Westboro, Massachusetts. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Sienna, it's great to be here with you. Thank you.
All right, so what's the core problem? I mean, I get that the batteries are huge, Mike, but what is the core problem in recycling these electric car batteries versus, say, a laptop battery or even a standard AA?
Yeah, so recycling batteries is something that we all need to do, and there are technologies that really haven't made recycling these lithium-ion batteries economic. And so there are older technologies that exist where you essentially smelt or you burn these batteries in order to get some of the valuable metals out of them. Of course, that's not very environmentally friendly. And then there's other techniques where you mechanically would shred some of these batteries and be able to get out some of the metals out of it that way, which is more environmentally friendly, but the output product there is not very economic.
Meaning you don't get much out of it that you can use again.
Right. Well, the problem is those types of materials cannot go directly back into a new battery. It needs further refinement, further processing, and therefore the value of those materials are very, very low. And so it doesn't make economic sense to recycle them. So we needed a better technology. And that's really what Ascend Elements has developed.
And in layperson's terms, can you give us the 30 seconds? Here's how it works.
Yeah, sure. So really, the technology was developed by WPI. Worcester Polytechnic, and they developed a way to synthesize new cathode material. This means making new material that can go directly back into a new battery. And we do this from spent batteries. So the material that we're making, this cathode material, which is the most expensive material that goes into a battery, we do it very, very economically and sustainably. And by making that really high value material in our recycling process, that's essentially what makes our process economic to the point where we are now buying battery material to upgrade it, upcycle it, if you will, and return it right back to the battery supply chain.
So basically, the way you do it creates less environmental impact and creates new material that can directly go into another electric car battery.
That is correct, yes.
And the concern, as I understand it, I mean, there's a lot of things here, but for you, it is part of the concern that you got to sort of ramp up your business before we've ramped up demand with enough electric vehicles?
Yeah, so we absolutely have to ramp up our business, and really the all of the technologies that are evolving now, we're putting in new capacity to recycle all of these batteries. And we don't necessarily have to wait 10, 15 years for an EV battery to reach its end of life. Actually, the largest source of battery material that needs to be recycled and processed is coming from the battery manufacturers themselves. They produce a tremendous amount of scrap material that needs to be processed. So you're absolutely right. This is an industry that is growing and growing now as a country and as an industry, as we're building all of these new battery plants. We have to have the ability to process all of this material and return it back to the supply chain. Ultimately, what we're doing is we're offsetting the need to mine things like nickel and cobalt and lithium, because once we pull it out of the ground and we refine it, we want to be able to recapture that and reuse it over and over and over again. So the process we've developed can do just that. We can infinitely recycle these batteries. and make that, battery material from it.
And that's important in addition to the obvious reasons, just briefly, both because the mining of those materials is bad for the workers and can be bad for the environment, and because it makes us less reliant on foreign partners to get those materials, right?
Absolutely. So if you look at where all of these materials come from, they come from all corners of the world. You know, as an example, Russia is the one of the world's leading producers of nickel globally, and that's has some obvious problems right now. But further, cobalt, the world's largest producer of cobalt is the Congo. And there's been a lot of association with child labor in the Congo mining the cobalt there. And so, you know, by offsetting that and not needing to mine as much and being able to reuse the materials that we've already pulled out of the ground is super important, super critical.
All right. That is Mike O'Cronley, who is the CEO of Westboro-based Ascend Elements, which is working on new technologies to recycle electric car batteries. Mike, I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
So Hiawatha Bray is here, technology writer for the Boston Globe, here in Studio 2 for our every other week tech talk. Hiawatha, your column put us on to this, so welcome. And let me start by your reactions to what you just heard from Mike.
Well, yeah, it's exactly as he said. This is a vitally important project if you're going to have this tidal wave of electric cars. There apparently is going to be this huge number of electric car battery factories opening in the United States over the next decade, putting out something like enough batteries to, as I understand it, enough batteries by 2030 to go into 11 million new cars. So we're really starting to see that ramp up. But just as we have to recycle the old school lead acid batteries from our cars today, we've got to recycle these batteries. And it turns out to be much harder because a lead acid battery is relatively simple. It's basically a stack of lead. In this case, you've got multiple very rare metals that you're going to have to separate out and then try to reuse. So something like this is really important, and it does take pressure off of the mining supply chain and give us a hopefully an assured supply of these minerals going forward, at least to a considerable extent. We're still going to need mining, but this is going to take some pressure off of that. It's a great idea.
And the innovations around this, some really are like, you know, like Ascend Elements happening here in the Commonwealth. Talk about
that. That's right. Absolutely. There's this company here, which started working on this, like, as I understand it, 10 years ago before anybody really thought this was going to be critically important. There's another company, I'm going blank on the name, I have them in my story. They are coming out of Harvard and MIT. They've got about $12 million of investment capital in them, and they claim to have come up with a way of doing much the same thing using electricity. Without any kind of heat, without any kind of liquids at all, they're going to pass electric current through ground-up batteries and use that as a way of separating out the minerals. Everybody's really scrambling to work on this, and it's a measure of the fact that around here in Massachusetts, it's not just the deaths of batteries, it's the birth of batteries. We've got a whole spate of companies in this area that have received something like $1 billion worth of investment over the last couple of years for figuring out new ways to build the batteries. Not just car batteries either. We've got a couple of them that are building batteries that are going to plug into the electrical grid so that when you have, for example, windmills, solar power, sometimes you're going to produce more power than you need right at that moment. So they're building grid batteries. Like there's one that is building, it's called Form Energy, and they're building their batteries out of iron. Now you can't make a laptop or a car battery out of iron. It's
That'd
too heavy.
A bit heavy.
But if you want to just build a stack of batteries and use it to power a city, it's perfect. Iron is cheap, it's plentiful, it's easy to recycle, and they think they're going to be able, and they're building a pilot plant right now, but ultimately they think they're going to be able to build something about the size of a standard power plant that could power a city of 100,000 for several days just on battery power. And that's being developed around here. Car batteries are also being developed. New kinds of lithium ion batteries that are, and they're, again, they're getting huge investments from the major car companies, from major electronics firms, because everybody sees that this is happening. We're not quite at the Model T moment yet, but we're getting very close to what I call the Model T moment, where electric cars are going to enter the mainstream, and the whole supply chain for this is going to have to be built out. And that means new and better ways to do batteries. And there's a lot of that action going on here.
So I want to talk about this sort of tipping point moment. But first, I think the company you're thinking about is Nth Cycle in Beverly.
Nth Cycle. That's the one. Nth Cycle is the other really interesting recycling play around here. That's right.
So let's talk about this Model T moment, which is sort of a tipping point where how does one put this in simple terms? You've got to develop the capacity to produce something, right?
Right.
There's got to be enough demand to make it profitable to produce the thing, but you've got to have enough production to kind of stimulate the demand. It makes me think of solar paneling and other right. solar power mm-hmm. technologies 20 years ago.
Right.
Are we in a question mark still about whether that tipping point's going to come? You sound quite certain. Oh, no, it's coming.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. The costs of these cars are coming down. More and more charging capabilities are being added, very slowly, but it's happening. Oh, and by the way, I should mention, I haven't written about them yet, but there's an up-and-coming company. They've got about $23 million. They're based in Somerville, and they're called Spark Charge. And they've come up with a really clever idea to deal with the classic charging problem. Mobile charging stations. Basically, they put a set of charging stations in a van, and you can drive to a particular location where somebody needs a battery charge. They set it up and charge your car while you wait.
Like they bring you a windshield now if you're windshield.
Exactly. It's like SafeLight or something like that. They will bring you batteries that plug into your car and charge you while you wait. And they've started running this service in a number of cities, not yet in Boston, even though they're based in Somerville, and I'm going to be writing about them in the near term. But everybody is coalescing around this challenge because, A, we really do need to find an alternative to gasoline. They call them ICE engines, internal combustion engines. So we call them ICE, of all things.
Who knew?
We need an alternative to ICE, but we also need a reliable way to build the batteries, recycle the batteries, and recharge the batteries. And all around us, right here in Boston, in Massachusetts, a bunch of people are all working on each one of those problems. It's kind of cool.
So how did we get here? Is it because of the universities and the technology centers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you summed it up. We have Worcester Polytechnic. We have MIT. We have Harvard. A lot of this technology is coming out of all of those. People forget, like, Duracell, the battery company. For many years, their R&D was based here. So we have dozens of battery engineers who have lived and worked in this area for years. It's sort of like the cluster we formed with robotics. A lot of the world's cutting-edge robotics technology is developed here because we have so many roboticists. We also have a lot of batteryists, if you will. There are tons of them in this area. And we're becoming, unfortunately, we're not going to become a manufacturing center for batteries.
Why?
Because it doesn't make sense to build them here. I mean, for example, take car batteries. Where are you going to build your car battery plant? You're going to build it near a car factory. You're not going to build it in New England.
We don't have a lot of car factories in New England.
Exactly. So most of the manufacturing of this stuff is going to happen elsewhere, I am sorry to say. But a lot of the intellectual property that's going to make it work is being developed right here, right now.
All right, so a couple more questions for you. I can imagine a listener thinking, okay, that sounds exciting and promising, but yeah. Right now, I can't afford an electric vehicle.
Right.
And if I had one, God knows where I would get it charged reliably so that my life functioned the way I need my car to function every day.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, the simple fact is that it's not yet fully practical for a whole range of consumers. But there's lots of things going on that are trying to change this. I'm desperately begging the Ford Motor Company to help me out on this one because, as I'm sure you've heard, perhaps the most closely watched electric vehicle of our time is the upcoming Ford F-150 battery-powered pickup truck.
Bum, bum, bum.
I believe they're out. Have they come out yet? I think they're out now. But I'm trying to get hold of one to borrow and test drive because that is really, I mean, the F-150 is the single most purchased vehicle in the United States. And if it catches on, if an electric battery-powered version of the F-150 catches on, that could be the tipping point because you don't get any more American than the F-150. And some of the early word that I've heard is that it's a really very fine vehicle with a lot of impressive capability. And if that turns out to be true, that's one of those moments when middle America that may be sneering at electric cars when they're Teslas might look at this and go, hey, this will work.
I could do that.
Yeah, I could do that. But it's going to be a while. I mean, it's going to take people underestimate how long it's going to take to do this transition. You hear people saying, well, we all be driving electric cars in a few years. No, we will not. People will be driving ICE cars for decades to come. Everyone that's leaving an assembly line right now will probably be on the road in 10 to 15 years.
All right.
And that's just not going to change.
I want to stay on Ford for a second, and it was released in April of 2022. I have not seen one on the road yet.
Right.
So last thing here, maybe we might have time for a couple of things. Yesterday, Ford's CEO Jim Farley made some waves, multiple news outlets reporting this. He said a couple of things. First, he talked about a price war on electric vehicles that was going to drive prices down. But he also called for non-negotiable prices and sales 100% online for Ford vehicles when they go electric.
Wow, I hadn't seen that. It's fascinating, but it makes sense. I mean, a huge amount of this stuff is moving online, and especially with new cars, I think it's quite practical now to buy and sell cars online. I don't think there is a barrier to doing that.
So what strikes me about that is we may not have automobile manufacturing here in New England, but we have car dealerships.
Absolutely.
Here in New England.
Absolutely. And it's going to be a challenge for them. It already is. Some of them are already, I mean, you already have car dealerships doing a lot of their stuff online. I just worked with my son to get a used car, and a lot of what we did, not all of it, involved shopping online. That's already become commonplace. And you have one of the leading companies doing that. Car Gurus is a local company where you can do virtually the entire car shopping process for a used car as well as a new car online. That's definitely the way things are going. A car is becoming almost like a smartphone in some ways, something that you just pick off a shelf, and especially if it's a new car, without any need to go through an involved retail process. I think that's practical.
I totally hear you. I'm having trouble transitioning in my mind. Like, I don't need to test drive a phone, right? Mm-hmm. I know how an iPhone, for example, is going to work, so... But I kind of want to test drive a car before.
Well, they can bring, if necessary, they can bring you the car and let you test drive it. That is something that they can do. And in some cases, they are doing. Well, they'll just put the car down in front of you and you can test drive it, and then they'll come and get it, and you can decide whether or not you want it. That's the way it's heading, I think. I mean, cars are becoming almost like transportation as a service. And we didn't even get into all the stuff that's going to happen with car software, both the good and the bad. That's going to be the next great tech consumer product, in a sense, is the car, because it's now becoming, in large part, a software device. And, well, Tesla's already shown us that with software that upgrades the capabilities of your car over time. On the other hand, it means that the cars are monitoring everything you do, how you use them, what you do with them. And the car companies are acting just like the phone companies. They're collecting just gigantic amounts of data about your cars. This isn't just electric cars. This is today's cars. And cars are becoming these data centers. And for better or for worse, they're watching us. So there's all this stuff happening. I'm glad you brought this up. There's endless stuff. I intend to spend more of my time writing about cars. It's really fascinating.
Then I intend to spend more of my time talking to you about cars on future Tech Talks. Okay. That's Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe and our regular guest for Tech Talk here on Radio Boston. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Struce again. Fires the three. And that might do it. Al Horford with the rebound, throws it up in the air, and the Boston Celtics will go to the NBA Finals.
Oh, yay! That, of course, the Celtics finishing off the Miami Heat on Sunday. Okay, but I'm not going to actually say of course, because that series was exhausting and it was nail-biting, and even that last game, honestly, not all that fun to watch if you're a Celtics fan. But nevertheless, now we move on to the NBA Finals against the Golden State Warriors, Game 1 tonight in San Francisco. Huge question marks, or maybe not, hanging over this incredibly talented team. So we want to give you everything you need to know to watch, whether you are a brand new fan or you have been in the thick of it all along. So here to help us out, Boston Globe sports columnist and author of Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics, Dan Shaughnessy. Dan, welcome back.
Well, it's nice to be back. I'm feeling a little more pressure today, though. I just learned that my wife is a huge fan of you and your program. So,
oh, no kidding. Tell her I said hey.
Yeah. I have to do better now.
So listen, how psyched are you for tonight? I know that's like total softball question, but I'm curious because, you love the Celtics.
Well, it's great theater. And these things don't come around that often. I mean, when I was a child, the Celtics were in the finals every year, winning it most every year. But the Celtics have not been in this position since 2010. So that's 12 years right there, and haven't won it since 2008 and have only won it once since 1986. So these are special moments. In New England here, we had 12 duck boat parades in the start of this century. And the last one was Tom Brady and friends winning in February of 2019. So we're 3 years into our drought, and this is the time for the Celtics to do something about that.
Can we?
Well, I think that I'm picking them to win, and that's not rooted in because I live here. I think they're a little bit better. I think nationally the Warriors are probably favored because they've won three championships in the last 6 years, but none in the last 4 years. And there's a chance for Boston. I think they match up really well with these guys. There's a great pedigree out there in California with they've got three guys who've been through this thing together six times and won three of them. So that's significant, and Boston does not have any players who have played in the finals, so this is going to be a new experience for them.
All right, so let's talk to specifically to the kind of newbies to basketball now who might be listening, who are going to tune into the game tonight because, I mean, NBA Finals. Give them two or three players and things to watch that anybody who's new could follow and really enjoy tracking tonight in the game.
Well, if you're a newbie, I mean, you just take a look at, you know, the Golden State's guard, Steph Curry. I mean, he's the greatest outside shooter in the history of basketball. So it's a lot of fun to watch this guy. He's not that big, 6'1", 6'2". Long range bomber, and just, you know, he makes shots from incredible open spaces way out there. So that's a guy you want to watch with them. They've got two other guys, Klay Thompson, very similar, you know, a great shooting guard, a rugged up front guy, Draymond Green. With Boston, you know, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are the two guys. They're both top three picks. And this is, they're young. They're 24 and 25 respectively, but they've been in the league for 5 and 6 years now. So this is their time. And Tatum, in particular, is a top five NBA player now and has just overcome great players in the first three rounds. He beat Kevin Durant in Brooklyn. He beat Giannis Antetokounmpo in Milwaukee and Jimmy Butler in Miami. So he has emerged as a superstar in the NBA, and this is his chance to shine and win a championship.
So you talked to some of the Lions of Celtics of old in preparation for tonight. What are they going to be watching for in this game?
Well, Bob Cousy is 93 years old, one of the great men of all time. I worship Bob Cousy. He still lives in Worcester. He's been there since graduated from Holy Cross in 1951. He was NBA MVP in 1957. So this goes back. And Cousy, of course, says it's hard for him to stay up for these 9 o'clock starts.
I think it's hard for a lot of people to stay up for a 9 o'clock start.
That's killing us with that thing. So we share that with Bob Cousy there. But yeah, he's very excited. You know, he said, I wasn't sure in my lifetime I'd see him have a chance to raise an 18th banner. Bob Cousy was, you know, he won six championships as a player with Bill Russell. And I also talked to Tom Sanders, who's, I think, 83 years old, or he's in his 80s, and he won six titles here. He coached the team. He was part of that Red Auerbach lineage with Bill Russell and Tommy Heinsohn and Casey and Sam Jones. So these guys are, you know, they're alive and well. They're watching. They feel connected when they watch this. It's part of the Celtic family. Their numbers are in the rafters. Larry Bird's numbers in the rafters. And you know, it's a continuous thing. The league's been going around for 75 years now, the NBA. The Celtics have the most championships, 17, with the Lakers. This is a chance to have more than the Lakers.
I got to tell you, there is just something about thinking about the fact that I might be sitting in my family room tonight, basically watching the game with Bob Cousy.
Yeah.
That makes me kind of happy.
Yeah, he would enjoy that. And, you know, he's such an alert guy. And he really follows closely. And he sees things. It's amazing the things he sees. He's still talking about, you know, Marcus Smart, the Celtic guard. He says, I love his game, but I wish he wouldn't take the three-pointers. Well, that's what a lot of us are saying when they watch Marcus Smart at the end of games. He can be a little reckless out there, but these old guys, they still got it, and they're still paying attention, and they feel a connection to the Celtics of today because of the Celtics of the past.
Okay, so in the control round, they want me to pick a little bit of a fight, saying the Lakers are counting five titles from Minneapolis and two that aren't even NBA titles.
Yeah, it's a continuous franchise. I understand what they're saying. So the Los Angeles Lakers have only won 12, but the Laker franchise goes back to the beginning of the NBA, and that franchise has won 17. So I don't get into that that distinction.
Yeah,
you want to have this.
You're past me. You're playing past me.
Yeah, Celtics have always had the distinction because they won 11 in 13 years from 57 to 69, and that really put them way ahead. And it's taken the Lakers many, many decades to catch up. And Red was always very competitive about that. So he would consider it a tie, and he would want to get the 18th to go ahead of them.
So let's talk about that, and let's talk about this franchise. You and I have talked a couple of times recently about this team and sort of the transformation of this team. But for the last 3 or 4 years, arguably there's been the potential there, and they just haven't been able to get it done. Talk about that journey and what's different now.
Yeah, it's a young team, and you know, they coached, Brad Stevens was their coach for quite a few years. It wasn't really, they weren't getting the kind of response they were hoping for. Excuse me. So Stevens, he moved upstairs last summer after a 500 season where they flamed out in the playoffs quickly. They brought in a rookie coach, Ime Udoka, who's a 44-year-old guy who played in the league, has the instant respect of his players. And they bought into this great defensive scheme he brings. He's a no-nonsense guy, kind of a low talker, serious. And you can feel the strength that he brings to the sideline and the fact that these young guys have bought into his system. It's been kind of interesting to watch because it took a few months. They staggered in November, December. They got much better in January. and have been the best team in basketball since like January 23rd.
That is really interesting to me, Dan, because I have found Ime Udoka fascinating, and I have found Steve Kerr, who's the coach of the Golden State Warriors, fascinating. He, of course, made some news last week at a press conference where he didn't talk basketball. He talked gun control. And I know that there is a narrative out there that coaches kind of don't matter, that it's the talent on the teams. I'm interested in your take on that.
It's a really good question and a good point in this sport. I think that you have to have the talent to get to this level. But when you have all these talented people, you still need some direction there. And I think that both teams have good leadership, good direction in that capacity. And you've got to get the young people to buy into what the coach is saying, no matter how talented they are. If they don't do that, you see teams flame out. And I think in this case, you've got two squads that have bought into what the leaders are doing. And there's a commonality. There's a great coach, Greg Popovich, in San Antonio, won a lot of championships. And both Kerr and Udoka came in under Popovich. So they kind of carry his way to these new franchises.
All right. Will we win this first game tonight?
Boy, it's tough. I mean, the Warriors have had more time to rest. They're home. I think they're 9-0 in the playoffs at home this year. This is the first finals game ever played in the Chase Center in Mission Bay there. So I don't like the Celtics in this game tonight. I think if they do, it's great because they were still playing, as we remember, Sunday night. They're right. Pretty banged up. They had to travel. The Warriors are rested. They're 9-0 at home. They've got the pedigree. This one, it wouldn't surprise me if Golden State wins this game.
All right, we will watch. That's Dan Shaughnessy, Boston Globe sports columnist and author of Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. Dan, this has been fun. Thanks so much.
Okay, I hope we can do it again. Take care.
You too. It's graduation season here in the region, and we have an abundance of great colleges and universities who are sending their students off to their futures. So today we want to bring you some of our favorite highlights from the region's commencement speakers. Adele Lim, screenwriter of the 2018 film Crazy Rich Asians, gave the commencement address at her alma mater, Emerson College, and encouraged the graduating class to imagine their futures in three acts.
This moment, this is your act one. It's the setup, the part of the movie where you tell the world who the main character is and what you want. All good main characters have a want. A want gives you drive, energy, excitement. It signals the kind of journey you're about to embark on.
CEO and founder of Chobani Incorporated, Hamdi Ulukaya, challenged graduates at Northeastern University to be warriors for change. Touching on his beginnings as a Turkish immigrant of Kurdish descent and his work with Ukrainian refugees at the Polish border.
As you go through life, there are going to be a lot of things about the world and society that makes you extremely uncomfortable or even angry. There are two things you can do about it. You can avoid it, you can ignore it, or you can work to change it. My hope for all of you today that you work to change it. I have found, on my experience, the richest life, the most beautiful life, is the life dedicated to helping others.
Cartoonist Keith Knight, co-creator of the series Woke on Hulu, returned to Salem State University to remind graduates there, don't stop learning, by making a hip-hop reference.
The real good music, you gotta look and search for it. It's called digging in the crates to find those beats. It's the same with history. It's the same with history. I want you guys to dig in the crates and find the history that will fulfill you, that will nurture you. And this experience, learning about Baldwin and Angelou and Wright, nurtured me in a way that I can't really describe in words. So keep on searching, keep on looking, keep on expanding. Each one teach one, tell your story.
Now this year saw a double helping of speeches. Many schools opted to offer in-person commencements for 2020 and 2021 grads who had lost their commencement ceremonies due to the pandemic. We all know Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's chief medical advisor and a guide throughout the pandemic. He applauded students at Roger Williams University for persevering through the pandemic to earn those degrees, and he called on them to eradicate the inequities in health that the U.S. has long had, but were laid bare during these last 2 years.
Together, we must draw on our wisdom, courage, empathy, and ingenuity to tackle entrenched elements of injustice manifested in so many subtle and overt ways to help heal this cultural disease and its downstream negative effects on health, just as we have worked to heal the viral disease of COVID-19. If ever the time was right to undertake this enormous challenge, it is now.
This year's speakers faced a daunting task. You're sending graduates off with encouragement and inspiration, but they were grappling with the reality of a commencement season that was bracketed by two mass shootings, 10 days apart, in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas. Many speakers leaned into the urgency of the moment, challenging students to take action to reshape their communities for the better. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern received a standing ovation in Harvard Yard just days after the devastating mass shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde. The gun massacres at two mosques in Christchurch in 2019 led to gun control measures in New Zealand.
Banning military-style semi-automatics and assault rifles.
She stressed that democracies depend on civil debate and dialogue over political differences.
These are significant issues, and they have not been without debate and difference. But they are all examples of times where we have navigated times of deep change without, for the most part, leaving deep rifts.
Tennis legend Billie Jean King encouraged graduates to look within and use the tools they received from their education at Springfield College to live authentic lives.
And in sports, the very best champions, the ones who win, integrate their head, heart, and guts. Interconnect them just like your spirit, mind, and body. And the great ones have all three going at the same time.
And that was before she started hitting signed tennis balls from the stage out into the audience. And last, singer-songwriter James Taylor. He urged the graduates of the New England Conservatory of Music to embrace their music as their spiritual food.
Make live music for live people. Whatever it takes and however you can manage it, alone or with other players, get your music in front of people. Make us one with everything.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. We'll go out today with James Taylor's Shower the People.
Shower the people you love with love. Show them the way that you feel. Things are gonna work out fine if you only will.
And hey, on behalf of the whole Radio Boston team, congratulations to all the graduates and their families.